I love that. Weepers music, New York street. Oh, he's got his mic going there. Great stuff. It just takes me back into that time, Nick Jerkis. Other Weepers, great novel about murder in New York back in the 50s, one early 50s, another one in the later 50s, but brings you back to those childhood years, right?
Yeah. Good years.
And the Yankees, I'm thinking Mickey Mantle and the Dodgers, you know, with the greats, Jackie Robinson. I mean, that was an exciting place to be as a kid.
It was, but the book takes place in 57.
Yeah.
And Milwaukee beat the Yankees.
That's right, they did. The Braves.
That's right.
Winning the final game in New York. I'm a total geek. So only weird kids like myself would. I didn't. In school, I tried to hide it, but it was hard. But yeah, the book, it just captures that feeling. What was your motivation, or what got you really motivated to really hit this and run?
Growing up, we didn't have a TV until much later, in my late teens. And in our neighborhood, it was poor neighborhood projects and stuff, we listened to stories that the older folks would tell us. It was great just sitting in a park, and my Uncle Mario would tell us stories about things he's done. And all those stories just stayed with me. And I wanted to write them as a novel because I thought that was the best way I could tell the truth. If I wrote it as nonfiction, I'd have to stick to the facts. But a novel gives you the chance to get feeling in
there. And was a young Nick, were you part of multiple characters or one character in particular? Or did you put yourself into this?
Yeah, Angelo, absolutely.
Angelo, yeah. But I you mentioned your Uncle Mario, and there's, of course, the scene, I won't give it away, but where, you know, the elder, the, you know, takes care of the youngster over a kind of a, you know, shady endeavor.
And, right.
You know, it just kind of the rules of the street, you know.
And that's what, you know, shifting into in real life now. I mean, that's what society has to understand about talking about people, kids growing up in poor neighborhoods, and why don't they do what the cops tell them to do.
Yeah.
It's a whole different culture, whole different norm, whole different values.
Well, you know, Margaret, I want to get you into the thing, too, but we, you know, we easily get into current social issues and current events as we slide through this. But you picked quite a heavy topic as well, the uncommitted, dealing with Catholic romance supernatural thriller.
Well, it's cross-genre, and really the essence of it is called magical realism, but we don't have a category really in the States that refers to that. It's more of like a Latin American term, or there's a lot of superstition and faith mixed in with taking place during real time. So she's the story, the crux of it is Josie is a messenger. So she receives kind of message, you know, like a psychic, but not so much about other people, but about her own life. So I guess, what can I say about it, Nick? Help me along here.
Well, talk about the Catholic part of it.
Okay. So there's a big Catholic piece to it because Josie's traditional. She was raised Catholic. She has a very strict belief system, but my book doesn't necessarily promote Catholicism. In fact, it's a little like Nick had mentioned, the Da Vinci Code, or a little bit of The Omen. There's an exorcism that actually happens in the course of the novel.
Oh, you always use a good exorcism,
you know,
on there,
so,
can't we?
But what happens is Josie's mother's own, she's dying of cancer, and that's when the book opens. And the mom is Italian, so there's a lot of culture in the book about their belief system growing up in the Italian culture. They believed in the saints and the relics and wearing crosses and holy water and all those, you know, the statues, all those things that represent traditional Catholicism. So her mother says, I'm passing on this gift to you when I die. And she said, well, I don't know if I believe you. And she said, well, trust me, this is going to happen. And when I pass, it's going to open up your world. Well, sure enough, her mother dies of cancer. She passes on this psychic gift to her. And Josie starts kind of freaking out and decides to pursue what was happening to her through some research studies. So she goes out and she starts researching around to see what, you know, what is this gift? And maybe it could be of use to some. Maybe I need to look at it differently. Well, she approaches her husband, and the husband is Irish. And so there's, she's an Italian-American growing up with very superstitious kind of beliefs and kind of almost mythology around her Catholicism.
Yeah.
And Declan is a staunch Irish Catholic conservative, and he's an attorney. They live in St. Paul, and he's got a reputation to uphold, and he does not like her messing with this psychic gift. He thinks it's bad not only for the family but bad for his reputation. So anyway, when she
started, Irish and Italian, there are going to be some fights in that hole.
Oh yeah, so it's there's a lot of conflict there. And so as Josie is this messenger, there's a parallel story, Andrew, and Andrew's a healer. And
What is the allure? Because my sister, you know, has always been into psychic things, and the allure of that genre.
I think what it is that there's people have these encounters that they want to know if there's something else going on in the invisible. Is there another realm? Is there more to life than this physical world? And I think for Josie, that her question is, you know, her mother died, and she's trying to maintain some sort of connection beyond the veil. And she can't believe that this is all there is, that life just ends at death, that there's some continuation.
Something more,
right. And I think a lot of people have that question because everyone's experienced loss.
Why do I think of that as something that women would be more prone to than men? Because I'm stereotyping men as, you know.
Right. And meat, I tend to have more female readers, yes. I do a lot of book clubs where I go and visit and talk about my book, mostly locally, although I've done some virtual book clubs online. So.
Yeah, and so it sounds like a fascinating, you're involving all these deep traditions and concepts that are on the minds of so many.
And I think for her, she's going up against her faith, where the faith that tells her that
conflict.
Right. So there's the occult piece of this that says you don't want to go there because you're messing with the dark side. So she's really torn. And as it turns out, when she does venture out and starts using her gift, she does encounter the dark side. And that's why it's called the uncommitted, because she...
And you'll tease us by not telling us what the gift is, otherwise we'd, you know, give it away, right? I mean,
she sees visions, dreams, telepathy.
Mm-hmm.
It talks about how she can perceive future or dips in... The way she puts it, she can dip into the chapters of time and pull information out.
Well, I mean, it's a universal yearning, because what percentage of people believe in some form of religion still? It's, what, 90%? I mean, you know, we just aren't comfortable with saying that's it, you know?
Right.
Go home at 5 o'clock and that's it. Nobody wants to believe that, or very few.
And I think a lot of people have had supernatural encounters or paranormal encounters or whatever you want to call it, or even perceptions that they've seen or felt the presence of a deceased loved one. And I think they're looking for validation. And I don't know if you'll ever get hard, substantial validation, but I think that's what Josie was after in her book.
Do you hold out for the possibility of this type of thing?
I do think there's studies actually going on. There's a couple of research studies going on in the country right now that have to do with afterlife communication.
I think of Houdini, right?
Yeah, and validation.
Wisconsin, well, from Hungary, but...
Well, this is kind of your life, too. I mean, in some ways, you've actually lived this, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's some similarities to my own life in the book. It's not true. It's meaning, my book is fiction, but I use some of my own personal experience.
Real-life undertones.
Yeah, like I'm a nurse. Josie's a nurse. Yeah, she's married with 3 kids, and there's some of that. And my own mother died of pancreatic cancer,
The Italian part? The Italian, the superstition.
So I wrote those traditions into the
book.
Right, yeah. So a lot of the beliefs in my mom.
What about the spouse, the Irish thing? Is that...
No, my husband's Irish, but he's not like Declan.
Well, I was going to say, my ex-wife was Irish on both sides.
Oh, okay.
And I'm Sicilian on my mother's side.
So funny. I'm Sicilian and my husband's Irish.
Matranga. Portraying Clutie and Standley. It was a lot of fire there.
Yeah.
Beautiful kids, but too much fire.
Too much fire.
Nick, you know, you hear this and you're a Renaissance man. I mean, you read and this book simply changed your life, this experience, has it not?
It has. And it's interesting that it changed my life late. So, you know, to everybody listening that's younger than me, and that's probably everybody listening, I would say, you know, you have time. You have time.
Well, you've taken care of yourself, too, as I embark on this diet. But, yeah, I mean, you have time, but you don't have time unless you eat some more vegetables.
And do what you want to do. If you want to write, you should write. But there's not a rush. Write what you...
All I do is an op-ed every 2 weeks in the State Journal. Not the same thing as a novel, but it's fun to write. I've always loved to write. Isn't it great?
It's hard, but it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
You're right about that. It's the hardest thing I do. I do the show, and I do comedy, or I do MC, but... Mm-hmm. That column, you have to be factual. check your sources 5 times, and it's draining.
That's right. Why writing fiction's so great. You don't have to worry about saying.
Wouldn't that be wonderful? Yeah, I mean, that's so true.
You just make it up.
I mean, I'm drained at the end of this column. Yeah. You know, it just wears me out.
You find that more difficult than doing the big show?
Oh God, yes. Entertaining that's fun.
Wow.
That's one of my most comfortable. Yeah, that's a nightclub act. But, I mean, you're writing a column. You got to make sure you're correct. In fact, you got to do the quotes accurately. I mean, there's a definite strain to that, big time.
Oh, yeah.
And people that write these nonfiction books, David
Halberstam. I don't know how they do it.
They must spend months in the library. I mean, back in the old days, the New York Library, David Halberstam would spend months there going over the notes. I mean, now.
Sure.
I mean, that would just wear you out. Wouldn't that be just amazing? Mm-hmm.
Lots of research. Lots of research.
But, yeah, we'll take a break. Come back. We can move into so many different tributaries here. Two books. Nick's Weepers, the novel about New York and the 50s and murder and, you know, all these different subplots. And also Margaret Goss, The Uncommitted, dealing with supernatural Catholic romance and a thriller. And conflicts with traditional Catholic rules and so forth, all these things. Wonderful stuff. Come back. The smart people, Nick and Margaret. Should be a group. You'd sing, go on tour. Anyway, The Mitch Hanks Show on MadisonTalks.com. I feel like I should be holding a gin and tonic. You know, I hear that music.
Is that right?
We were talking about we should have cocktails.
I'm going to go somewhere after the show and have something fizzy. maybe a lime in there. Some jazz? Maybe we'll talk about this. But something on the diet, though, because that would throw me off the diet, you know. But Nick Chiarkis is here, the author of Weepers, Margaret Goss, The Uncommitted. Nick, you were saying earlier about this concept of poor people not cooperating with the cops, and we just had a Broadfest fight. And Michael Johnson, the Boys and Girls Club, was saying it wasn't a gangland thing. He was saying it was teenagers, fighting, and the three arrests, two were females. And the public said, oh, give me a break. It sounds like a gang thing. And there's, you know, gangs have different levels, different connotations, but... the peer pressure and all those things you talked about, because I think a lot of people in the public and older people just want people to conform and follow the rules and obey authority like they did or thought they did.
Right.
Is it your position that no one ever really did, or is that just a myth?
Oh, no. I think that generally our middle class and upper class, if we could talk about class structure, there's an expectation that kids will do. I'll tell you a story. Without mentioning names, a former governor, I should tell you who it is, Scott McCallum, once we were sitting around talking with other cabinet members, and there was some kid that got in a lot of trouble at school. I don't remember exactly what it was. But anyway, he made the offhanded comment that back when he was a kid, if he came downstairs to breakfast in the morning after saying something like that to a teacher, that his father would let him have it.
Oh, sure.
And so what I said immediately, I said, there's three things that's wrong with that in the lower class. First, you came downstairs to the breakfast room. Yeah. Second, there was breakfast. And third, your father was there. So
yeah.
I understand.
And I don't think it's a purposeful distance. I think we think everybody, if you're part of that group, and I'm part of that group now, you think everybody lives by those same nice norms, the father knows best norms. But the lower class, it's not just kids. The lower class has a whole different set of norms, and they want their kids to stick with that set of norms, and the expectations are that set of norms. Now, kids will be kids whatever.
Right.
And kids will get in trouble. But there is a difference.
So poverty, though.
Poverty makes a big, is huge. It's not just about.
Plays into the whole value of authority or lack of value.
So
toward authority.
When I was a kid, if I got into a fight with a rich kid and we both were killed, we both fell off a building during the fight, I would feel as though I won because he has more to lose. And kids growing up that feel that way express themselves differently in a study at Columbia University during Father Knows Best years. Mm-hmm. They asked poor kids and middle-class kids, would you like to be friends with Bud Anderson? And they all want to be his friend. Lower-class kids would become his friend by beating up someone that he's afraid of, whereas upper-class and middle-class kids would join his football team or his culture.
Well, and of course, this recent Bratfest fight got a lot of headlines, and people are appalled. They closed a little early, the carnival closed early. I guess there was, but people say, "Well, you know, what's going on?" And there's shootings you read about, and people say, "Oh my God, we're becoming New York."
Right.
There's a long way to go before that happens, but
right.
You know the feeling. Of the older crowd,
and we feel older crowd like it's out of control, and all we want is somebody to stop those kids and make them behave. And that's why we have police in schools. That's why in the 50s, when gangs were at their peak, there was a proposal to put cops in schools. And folks in New York just protested it. They thought that was outrageous.
Right. Well, I got to tell you, and Margaret, we'll get back to you here, and you can weigh in on this from your own perspective as well, and what your background was. But I got to tell you, having done some subbing in the past in schools, it's tough to get them to.
It is.
Sit in their seat or stop talking. I mean, it's tough.
It is. No doubt. I want to say something about Uncommitted, though.
Yes,
Before I forget. That is an award-winning book.
That's right. And we were just talking. go ahead, Margaret. It was a good setup.
I'm
Nick
just
Jarkus.
Interesting to all.
Nick, your press agent. Go ahead. I mean, it's a good point.
Well, as far as going back to what you were saying before, I am a school nurse.
So you've seen a variety of things.
So, yeah, I spent a lot of time at all levels. So I hear what Nick is saying. And, yeah, I think their priorities are different with the kids who are in poverty. I mean, how do you learn if you're hungry? I mean, you got to make sure you have breakfast.
Right.
You know, so we always start in the health office.
But I sense it's beyond that, though, because the lack of compliance or conformity is so deep. I mean, sitting or paying attention.
Well, I think, yes, there's a lot at play, and there's and I can't even grasp it, but I will tell you this, and this sounds, I can't even believe I'm saying it, but I must be getting old, because I think music, the artists out today, so to speak, and I listened to a lot of 90s grunge, which was, you know, irresponsible as it was, but if you listen to the music now that my own kids listen to, you know, there's like no disregard for humanity. I mean, it's just the ideals that they're putting forth in some of the music, I guess. So that's what I'm getting at. It's like the standard, we've lowered our standards, and that's become acceptable. You know, when the cursing or whatever, it's just not
derogatory.
It's derogatory
terms toward women and so forth.
Correct. That's what I'm getting at.
It kind of coarsens the culture.
Yes.
But the respect thing, and Nick, I'll come back to you, and we can talk about this in your calls as well, 210-1667, 210-1667, madisontalks.com. You can hear Nick Charka's podcast on madisontalks.com. Great stuff. As this will be a standalone podcast soon, too. Fear, though, and I use this analogy, I call it the Bobby Knight story, because I went to the camp twice, and 13, 14, and these kids, I'm not afraid of him. You know, talk yeah. smack during cafeteria. I'm not afraid of him. He's a blowhard. Yeah. But as soon as he would walk in, those kids, I mean, I'm not yeah. sure that they...
Well, I think, you know, like, where I spend time working is, there's a lot of very respectful
there's
kids.
No fear, is my point. I mean, there's you yeah. say, don't talk. They're not going to... pay attention.
Well,
I
had kids
going to the, some kids going to the gym to get away from class, and you say, you can't be in here, and they just ignore you. I mean, they just keep shooting baskets.
Yeah.
I mean, that wouldn't happen in the Bob Knight story. I mean, he would grab them yeah. by the neck or something, or put them on a greyhound, you know. But that doesn't happen, right? I mean, it just...
Never happens.
You can't lay your hand
never
on
happened?
Kids anymore.
But, well, no. he was a bad example, but he would do that, yeah.
My experience at the schools that my kids have been at, they've been very respectful, and we have a very diverse student population.
It's good to hear.
And I think it has a lot to do with the staff at that school and the standards and the expectations that have been set.
And knowing how to...
And there's consequences.
Knowing how to deal with it, you know.
Yeah, they've got... a multifunctional way of dealing with each group, too. It's not...
Oh, if you've subbed, so. You want teachers all to get a pay raise. You see it.
Yeah.
You see it firsthand. We'll come back with more. And the Mitch Hanks Show at MadisonTalks.com. I feel like I'm under the highway, the Jets and the Sharks, from West Side Story. No, New York music. But Margaret Goss is here, author of The Uncommitted, and I don't want to mention the award you received here.
I've received a couple or a few. The first one, I was shortlisted in the United Kingdom for a contest. It's called Book Viral, and I was in the top 50 of new authors, so
oh,
that they ranked
you.
Me. So that was my first one out of the gate. And then my second award, I won the Midwest Independent Publishers Award for my cover.
Well, hey.
Hey, it's a, and then my third was...
You can judge a book partially by its cover.
I just won... I was a finalist in the Indie Book Awards in the category of horror.
Oh, indie.
Indie, yeah, independent.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah. So,
book well, that's cool, man. All these things going on there.
So, yeah. So my book, it, like I said, is cross-genre, and it deals with a lot of, it deals with faith, it deals with the spirituality, it deals with family, it has a lot of universal themes.
You know what's encouraging in all those awards, and Nick, you're talking about the feedback you've been receiving on your book, is that people still are in the world of books more mm-hmm. than... And again, I'm not sure what the age group difference is there and the millennial thing, where they don't necessarily have the attention span, I suppose. But it's kind of gratifying, isn't it? I mean,
it is. It is. People are reading. People are still reading.
It could be the cable's too much money, or, you know, people don't wanna, I know a lot of people that don't have cable because it's, you know, a budget thing. So maybe they read because, you know, they have three channels. I don't know. I mean, otherwise you could just come home and stare at the 500 channels or whatever the case.
I'm actually
YouTube.
Surprised at how many people still like having a paperback too, not just the Kindle book.
Yeah.
So even though you have that immediate access,
well, you
still sell.
Hit the wrong, lose your place, or, you know, hit the wrong. It's, you know, you got to be coordinated.
Yeah.
Turn a page, you got a fighting chance. But we're talking about youth, and you work as a nurse, Margaret, and Nick talking about kids. The zero tolerance thing, you don't think it was a good idea?
No.
Discipline?
Kids always need somebody that'll sit down with them and help them cool down. The first things they say or the second things they say aren't really how they feel. They're doing something for their friends.
Right.
And if you zero tolerance and as soon as somebody talks back
right.
to a teacher, you're calling the cop in the school.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You're going
right.
to get – it's going to at least look like there's a lot more
– it'll get worse, right?
Yeah. And it doesn't get better from there.
Well, my limited subbing, I'd say, hey, so you're a leader. I'd try to engage the
sure.
the misbehaving and say, you're the leader here. and just, hey, so nice hat or you like the? I mean, is that not stupid or is that
no,
smart?
No, I think that's right. I was I was a cop on a beat.
Yeah,
and you don't arrest every person that gives you a bad look or says something to you. You know, you build relationships. You find out that tough kids really have a soft inner self. They're protecting themselves.
Give that a chance.
Give it a shot. There's nothing to lose unless you take it very personally.
Unless you get hit in the face or, you know, right. Somebody pulls a knife, you know.
Then it's a different club.
Different, yeah, right.
But if it's just unruly kids, and some of them, you have to take action, but others.
I think what happened with this Broadfest fight was there were five different fights, which was unnerving. It wasn't just one thing.
And it looks like one big gang.
People envision sprawling, violent mayhem. You know, like it's a
no, it's a couple of shoves
game.
And a punch and a kick.
You know, it's funny. I was there that night when it all and I never saw any of it. We were at a concert at the main stage.
You missed it all. Yeah.
And I missed the whole thing. Well, and all I knew was that it was shutting down and they were closed for the night after the concert. I was like, okay, it's over. And it wasn't until later we found out it was because
Well,
of
apparently
this.
A couple of kids did a little Facebook picture like, I'm cool. The cops are here, you know. But thinking back, we used to go to corning as kids. We'd chuck the corn, and we'd put it in our socks with all this corn, and we'd throw handfuls of corn at the houses and run. We're like nine. And the really exciting moment was when the cop car came. Oh, that was big.
That's right.
So, I mean, nothing's really changed, right, in that regard?
No. And it depends on how you react, how the teacher reacts, how the cop reacts, and what the kids are doing. And gangs are a problem. If there's a gang, that's a different problem.
Well,
that's a whole different problem.
Hearing mixed reports on that on and off the record. But, you know, I mean, of course, there's the real violent gangs, and there's the teenage gangs. I mean, it's kind of hard to explain that to the general public, you know.
Right. There's kids that group together. They give themselves a name.
Well, isn't the ice cream social of the church a gang, as it were? I mean, the Rotary Club, the
Boy
Lions
Scouts.
Boy Scouts, they're good gangs. I mean, people are in very few people want to just live alone and watch Netflix, you know, and pull down the shades, right?
And they want to be identified.
Sense of community. Everybody's looking for a sense of community.
Yeah, right.
And you look for people with similar values, similar dress, similar backgrounds. I mean, you gravitate towards what you know, right?
Women's groups. You know what I always because I've done a couple of comedy things for women. There was the Lois Club. Women named Lois were in this club. And I always thought it was funny because the women's clubs, they always have to have a treasurer and a president.
And a secretary.
Secretary and meet. Whereas men will just go to the bar and, you know, order a beer and sit there, you know. And women will too, but it's just, there has to be some structure.
We have, like, function, yeah.
Function, purpose.
Like a booster club. I'm on booster club. Yeah, we get together for drinks to plan booster club activities.
Yeah. If you went to the bar and ordered a drink by yourself, you know, somebody would talk about it, right?
Right, but a guy does it and nobody
cares.
Yeah, right. It looks sad when the woman goes and orders a drink by herself.
I got news for you. It's sad when a man does it, too. But it's a different definition.
I have to stop doing that. Huh?
Yeah. Well, but it's so true, right? I mean, we have all these double standards. And as I wanted to stand up, I mean, you could say whatever you want about men. Make fun of men, call men names, people laugh. Can't say anything about women, ever.
Yeah.
It's, you know, so all those thousands of years of bondage still plays a factor, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, isn't it amazing?
It is.
Because on the one hand, we preach equality and, you know, everybody, but then we don't have it when it comes to a lot of social customs.
Well, I think my wife is going to get mad at me if she's listening. I think that women are more comfortable talking and being in a social situation. Men, if they're talking about something, they'll sit side by side and not look at each other, whereas women will look at you when they talk to you. If men are looking at you, they're averting their eyes as they're saying something. And it is, my wife has accused me of knowing somebody for years and not really asking them any deep or sensitive questions, whereas
guy talk,
yeah, just guy talk,
superficial.
Yeah, I wouldn't ask him that.
Cars, sports.
But my wife knows all her friends. I mean, they know everything there is to know about each other, and I think that's cool.
The deep underbelly.
Yeah, and that might be more about why we're afraid To say bad things say about women. Things.
Well, that could be it. I was shocked when I heard years later my mother tell me stories about how childhood friends' parents' wives were having affairs. I mean, I would learn this from my mother years later. Mrs. So-and-so had an affair. I mean, I'm just shocked. Oh, yeah.
But your mother knew.
But you know, they'd confide in her, you know, and she would tell me this years later, and I remember just being shocked.
Well, Josie in The Uncommitted, I'm pushing her in the next one. She meets this guy.
Yeah, so, yeah.
I won't tell you how that goes.
Yeah,
but
Josie is, yeah, she's in a traditional marriage with the oppressive conservative husband.
looking for an escape.
Yeah, well, not exactly. The escape just kind of happens. But Andrew, she's a nurse. Andrew's a healer. He's a physician. So their paths naturally cross.
And, yes. It's so amazing how they, well.
And he's, I don't want to say, like, he's kind of the savior character, even though he's not Christ. There's a lot of metaphor in my book. So,
yeah. Well,
so some things happen to Andrew that are very symbolic.
I see. So I love that you say the escape happens. You know, people tend to be looking for things to happen subconsciously or whatever the case. Have we met before? You look familiar. I mean, all these lines that are superficial. It's amazing how that works. But we have a country now that is very divided on so many fronts. And, Nick, you've been around long enough to know, I mean, you talk about how human nature has not changed or kids haven't changed, but were we ever this culturally and socially polarized as we are now? I mean, ever? I mean, I don't remember it.
I think so. If you think about, I know everybody's talking about Nixon. I see a big difference in what's happening with Trump and what's happening with Nixon. But if you think about the Nixon years, the Vietnam years, I mean, there was a whole society that was dropping out. And there were riots. I was a cop in the 60s. There were riots mm-hmm. in New York City. Young, lovely co-eds at NYU referred to me as a pig as I stood on a line. I think that kind of polarization, George Wallace was running for president.
Well, that was on the extremes, right, the political.
Well, if you take the Stand Up for America group with George Wallace,
yeah,
and you start pushing them back into more of the Nixon Republican Party.
Hard hat.
Yeah, yeah. You have that divide between police and hard hats versus college professors and intellectuals,
oh, sure,
et cetera, et cetera, right?
Sure. And that always, well, frankly, when I was a kid, going to my mother's parties and, you know, or going to the ball game and before the game, the vodkas and the martinis, they all hated Nixon. I thought Nixon had no chance. I thought McGovern was going to win.
Yeah, right.
Because my family and their friends all hated Nixon. So Nixon won by 49 seats. Oh, what happened there? You know, so yeah, there was division. But now there's just hatred that I don't remember it at all being
and
the same.
I don't know if it's the same kind of hatred or we now have permission not because of Trump necessarily, but because of social media.
Yeah,
to say it out loud.
It. Yeah.
We're empowered.
Well,
to just vent our darkest.
And people aren't, but yeah, they don't like to be held accountable for what they say, though, as soon
right.
as you call
no,
them out on it.
That's right. Because
so,
and from a radio
you want
host,
the right to be able to blast your opinion, but you don't want the right. You don't want somebody to come back and say,
come back at you.
Right.
I'll do that with emails, and I'll say, "Well, I'm sorry you feel that way." Oh, Mitch, I didn't think you'd read that, or you know, in the case.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
You have a lot of courage behind the keys, you know. Mm-hmm.
Or with somebody told me,
but
instead
yeah,
of
yeah.
You would never say some of the things that are getting said online. You would never say to a person's face, and I like the empowerment. Exactly what you're saying. It's like because back in the day, you had to tell someone how you felt face to face, or you didn't tell them at all. You just walked away.
Right.
Now you throw bombs out on the internet, so to speak.
Well, you know, Nick mentioned the zero tolerance. That could apply to relationships too, because I mean, the one fight, the one comment, insulting comment, could end oh, a relationship.
People, yeah, or, people unfriend each other on Facebook all the time because of something that gets said, and then they don't speak for years or whatever, and it's like, what?
Right.
Or something silly.
It's right. Some my share of breakups after 4-month relationships back in the day over a comment over a drink, you know, and that'd be the end of it, time to go home or time to, mm-hmm. So it can happen. So I guess the key is not to say those things. Or maybe it is. Maybe you find out the truth if you do say it, right? You don't want to spend 40 years with the wrong person, which, you know, happens.
Well, I don't think the internet allows for a filter, so to speak.
Well, no, talking about dates. Yeah, I know. Yeah, the internets have cheapened it all.
Yeah.
Know?
I mean, there's no filter anymore. Like you said, no fear. People just say what's on their mind and they don't. But, and then there's the other aspect of it is you can't take it back once it's said either. Once it's out, you can delete the comment, but it's out there. And
well, I'm just processing this as a young man dating this gorgeous young woman who went to Hillsdale College. And of course, I was very liberal then as a youngster, brainwashed by my mother. And she was going to this conservative college, and she made the comment in passing, and she was just gorgeous. And I was young and, well, whatever. And she once said, well, they taught us at St. Thomas Aquinas that Martin Luther King covered sin like snow. I went, what?
What?
And I just got that Sicilian Al Pacino thing in the back of my neck. And now I'm not looking at her as this hot woman. I'm looking at her as, what the, you know?
Yeah.
And it just, like, ruined the relationship was ruined just by that comment because of my political upbringing and all that. But I just, boom, one line. And then, like, 2 weeks later, why did I get mad? Well, why did I, you know.
So. But, you know, that comment revealed something about her character.
Well, or maybe mine. So, I mean, you know, she was learning whatever she learned. And, you know, with Nick, I should have just, you know, smiled and said, oh, what do you mean?
Be tolerant.
Be tolerant. Yeah.
Talk about it. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, right.
My parents, you know, being Sicilian, my father and mother were first generation Italian-Americans. And there was a lot of hostility?
Oh, sure.
Prejudice towards the Italians.
Yeah. Oh, sure, yeah. Well, so, you know, my mother, you know, she was hot-headed. I mean, a lot of public displays of profanity when I was growing up. I mean, woman who didn't like Nixon because he approved the land grant for Purdue. I mean, let's face it. I mean, you go deep on some of this stuff.
Wow.
That's hardball, isn't it?
I didn't even know that.
Oh, yeah. In fact, Indiana-Purdue is a rivalry that people around here don't. I mean, real rivalry. What do we have, Minnesota? It's like a tea party. It's nothing. You know, it's not the same thing. But no, we're talking about family. We're talking about culture. You're talking about the Catholic Church, and Nick's talking about the old neighborhood. But these are deep, you know, value building things. Go deep, and now we have this society with people with social media and the phone, and I wonder if millennials, and the one thing about reading books is we had to read the books to learn things when we were young. I mean, I learned as a kid that Ted Williams batted 344 because I read that.
Right.
Now you can just look it up in 5 seconds, and they don't value learning it. You just find out about it.
Yeah, we kind of went from wisdom to knowledge, to information.
Right.
And we didn't even see how it was changing.
Well, David McCullough, who wrote Truman and wrote John Adams and wrote 1776, talked about the kid that knows all the dates and all the trivial, which was me, but I tried to have it in context. But he said, that doesn't make you smart, it makes you weird. So it's a fine line between weird and smart. Because I remember the kid, it was love it. I would impress the adults. So, so-and-so is batting this, or so-and-so, you know.
Right.
You don't take so much of that kid, right?
Right.
So you learn that. but these books are, it just, there's a wealth of life and wonder and intrigue and horror, in fact. In the case of Margaret, well, there's a little scary element to Nick's book, too.
Yeah. I mean,
a little
bit.
Murder is murder.
Yeah, a little bit.
Nick's is violent.
Violent. And you felt that as a kid walking away from the street, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I was always scared as a kid walking down the street. I always found myself by habit. I think I told you this, looking in windows of shops to see if there was anybody behind me. Or somebody across
or
the
street. Or walking along the roof. You walked along the roof.
Roofs. I love the roofs. Not a lot of people were comfortable up there. But I love being on the roof. And just can go from street to street that way.
I was reading some stuff on Frank Sinatra in Hoboken. And he was knew which streets to avoid.
Yeah.
They call him a guinea bastard. And go home, you dago bastard, and all this kind of stuff.
And as a kid, you know that. You know which areas the chaplains rule and which areas the sportsmen or the Ford and Baldies or whatever gang might have been around.
But having gone through all that, you wonder, the kid who grows up in the nice upper-class neighborhood in Mequon, are they missing out? You're saying they're not missing out.
No.
Well, your kids were in a much better place, right? I mean, in terms of
affluence. My oldest daughter and oldest son I raised as a single parent grew up while I was a cop and was growing up in Manhattan. My youngest, Josh, was born and raised in Middleton, Wisconsin. And he's bright and beautiful and good friends with his siblings and...
He's not worse for the wear for not having been afraid to walk down the street.
No, he's not. He went to Edgewood High School.
You're happy he wasn't afraid walking down the street.
Right. And that was better for me. I didn't have agita every time he left the house.
Well, I mean, let's face it, that sucked. You would have liked to walk down the street and not been afraid.
That's right.
But it made you who you are, though. I mean, you're resilient and you're tough and you're probably not going to give up easily, right?
True.
And how much of that is your environment? How much of that is your, childhood, your parents? I mean, it's all part of the mosaic, right?
It is. And, people like Sutherland and Robert Merton basically said that by the time you're 11 years old, your character and a lot about you has been formed. Yeah, mm-hmm. And shaped. You could change it. You can redesign yourself, and certainly you can keep learning.
Sure.
But those feelings that shrinks try to pull out of you, they're there.
They're there for a long time, aren't they? And if you've come from Mediterranean culture, you should get rid of those grudges because they've been around for 40 or 50 years.
Yeah, I still get, when I get out of a car, I still stay below the window a little bit when I'm getting out. I still look inside windows if I'm walking down a street without even thinking about it. I'll still walk in to Eno Vino with my wife. And she will say, you look around at every table like there's something wrong in here.
You're casing out the joint.
I can't help it.
Casing it out.
Yeah. Let's not sit here. Let's go over there.
New York cop. Once a New York cop, always a New York cop. And Margaret, are we going to see more books after this?
Yeah, I'm working on my second book now, the sequel to The Uncommitted. And right now the working title is called The Messengers because Josie's children are gifted too.
Oh, they're gifted. Well, of course they are.
Of course.
Andrew's going to be in there, right?
Yes, Andrew figures very prominently. Yeah.
I'm just curious, how long did it take you, Nick, to write your book?
Oh, if I put it all together, the research probably took about 2 years and the writing took about the same.
So 4 years total.
Yeah, but at least half was research.
Yeah. Margaret?
On and off, 9 years.
9 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wrote drafts and put stuff down, and then I would pick it up later and rewrite. And I went from, I first wrote it in first person, then I went to third person, and then I went from past tense to present tense. So there were all those kinds of changes, too, that went on in the book.
Well, that's fascinating, is that there's such depth and time. It's not like you got on a roll and you were on a deadline and you got to have this done by next week.
No, I wanted my first, book to, I really wanted to take my time with it, and it still wasn't perfect when it came out. It's still not perfect, but it'll never will be. I had to let it go at some point, so.
It's not like when
move on,
We know somebody went to L.A. and had a week to write a screenplay. They were just locked in a room for a week.
Wow.
Jeez.
But that's not the same thing.
No.
That's meatball surgery.
And that's work.
That's work.
That's just work.
Yeah.
This was labor of love, wasn't it?
This is more creativity. Yeah, I'm feeling a little more pressure to get the second one out.
Oh, really?
Because I have people waiting to hear what happened because I left them in a hangar.
I'm just curious. Do you both
left them hanging.
Oh, you left them. Mm-hmm. Do you have cable at home, both of you, or no?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You do, yeah.
Have you seen, there's the story by the Duffer Brothers. I'm not thinking of it right now.
Well, I'll think about it and we'll come back. This has been a fascinating conversation Nick's book is Weepers. And Nick, give me the, is it available everywhere or just on Amazon.com?
Yeah, Amazon, just about every place. Every Mystery place. To Me on Monroe Street.
Mystery to Me on Monroe. And Margaret, same with you?
Yep, it's at Barnes & Noble, East, and I believe still at West. Amazon, Mystery to Me, University Bookstore. It's at Plum Crazy, which is a really cool gift shop. And Woodman's Sun Prairie.
Oh, Woodman's Sun Prairie. There you go.
So,
The Uncommitted. And also Weepers. Great stuff. And the more you read, the more you know. The more you know, the farther you go. Okay.
Stranger Things. That's what I was thinking of. Stranger Things, a Netflix series.
That's a great series.
My book, The Uncommitted, people have told me I should make it like Stranger Things. Yes. That it should be a Netflix series. So I'm getting going on my second book. So maybe I'll get to meet the Duffer Brothers one day.
I want to ask about Stranger Things because I just watched the entire fifth season of House of Cards in like 1 week. Very disturbing. The Mitch Hanks Show on MadisonTalks.com.
Welcome back to the Mitch Hanks Show. Mitch seeks the truth by inviting all sides of the issue. Thanks for listening to the Mitch Hanks Show.
Okay, you can watch this on MadisonTalks.com, the podcast. Also, it'll be saved as a separate standalone podcast on Nick Chiarkas' podcast page, On the Beat with Nick Chiarkas. And he's got great podcasts on there already, and the earlier interviews are fantastic. I've heard great feedback from friends who have heard it. And by the way, you can do your own podcast here. It's a new world. You can do a podcast when you record, as we were tonight. We're live all over the world, live. And after we're done, it'll be preserved as a podcast on MadisonTalks.com 24/7 forever and ever and ever. You can listen to it while you're walking your dog on your phone. That's the new world. You know, when you want to listen, not when it's on at 8 o'clock on Thursday. Not the Untouchables or the Fugitive. You can hear it whenever you want. We also thank the Facebook Live people, and we appreciate that very much. Margaret Goss, Nick Chiarkas, we thank you. And
when's the next big show?
I don't have one scheduled. I'm too busy with Cannibalistic Survival. We'll talk about this. But, we thank Bob Keller of the Keller Real Estate Group for the space here on West Washington Avenue. Check out his properties, Tuscan Place, Washington Court, Westside Seniors, and Whitcomb Square. Go to kellerapartments.com. That's kellerapartments.com. The nicest guy you'll ever meet, Bob Keller. We thank Mike Brockevelt, our studio engineer. We got Bob Abella next. Wide Roller Radio, Classic Radio next on the MadisonTalks.com.